Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I am your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from just outside of Washington, D.C., where the Capitol is quiet now after a long series of hearings before the House Intelligence Committee on the impeachment inquiry into the impeachment of the 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. People have gone home now. They're heading home for Thanksgiving. And the real question is, what's your Thanksgiving going to be like, right? How's it going to be in 2 days when you're sitting around your Thanksgiving table with your members of your family talking about the impeachment of the president? Here's my guess. Those that defend Donald Trump didn't watch the hearings because they don't want to know the facts, because the facts are uncontested. This is the most important thing that you need to get across to your friends and family at the Thanksgiving table. The facts are uncontested. No one disputes that the President of the United States was trying to use his office to promote his personal political advantage. He was trying to extort a foreign government, Ukraine, to intervene in our elections, to make up a false investigation into Joe Biden and Joe Biden's son, the company Burisma, and trying to put forward Vladimir Putin's conspiracy theory that Russia did intervene in our elections, despite the facts that all the intelligence agencies said so. It was actually Ukraine. Everyone has debunked this. But if anyone in your family continues to remember it, continues to state something that is completely untrue, ask them to watch the hearing. Sit down with them. Play for them the testimony of patriots like Dr. Fiona Hill and Lieutenant Colonel Vidman, or any of them, even the witnesses the Republicans called, Morrison and Volker. Play Ambassador Sondland. This is the guy that gave $1 million to Donald Trump to be an ambassador and was a Trump crony. Even he admits there was a quid pro quo. If anyone disputes, you sit them down and you watch the hearings. Meanwhile, we have other things going on. We have the Secretary of the Navy being fired because he refused to not discipline an American war criminal, a guy who actually was posing with the body, the corpse of someone he had just killed. It's against the Uniform Code of Military Justice. He was being disciplined. The president didn't want him being disciplined, and the Secretary of the Navy had to go because he was trying to follow the law rather than Donald Trump. I've got a really special guest on this hour that is going to be joining me to talk about all of these things. His name is Colonel Cedric Layton. He is the founder and president of Cedric Layton Associates, which is a strategic risk consultancy company. Colonel Layton was in the U.S. Air Force for 26 years as an intelligence officer. He's also regularly on CNN. And I've asked him because I want to get an insider's view into the kind of people we've just seen over the past couple of weeks come and testify. Colonel Layton, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, Mark, thanks for that, and it's great to be with you again.
It's really great to have you here. My first question for you is, before we get to the specifics of what happened with the Navy and all of that, did you watch the impeachment hearings, and what did you think of people who do a lot of what you did coming forward and testifying?
Well, I certainly did watch them. I mean, that was the most important TV show in town, quite frankly. And it was, something that, really brings to the fore all the different currents of thought that are, that are going on, what the Republicans are saying, what the Democrats are saying, what the truth is when it comes to all this testimony. And the people that testified, the fact witnesses, as most of them were called, I think were an impressive bunch. You have, like you mentioned, Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman. You have Dr. Fiona Hill. You have the former ambassador. You have so many different people that I think exuded in my opinion, a great deal of professionalism. In essence, they were a version of America's finest. You had a military man, you had many State Department people, you had obviously a political appointee, but all of them ended up, whether they wanted to or not, they ended up saying something that I thought was very important. And in their specific ways, the things that they talked about, not only shed a light on how foreign policy is supposed to be done, but also shed a light, more importantly, on how things were unfolding within this administration and, quite frankly, how things are not supposed to be done when it comes to foreign relations, especially, in regards to an ally like Ukraine. And that becomes a, rather interesting situation where you have people talking about certain sets of facts. The witnesses tended to corroborate each other throughout the testimony. And, while you listen to the questioning, it really depended in which camp the questioner was as to, how far they would go with that questioning and whether or not that question was more a political posture statement. And that, that was quite quite instructive, not atypical, but quite instructive. But I was very proud of all the fact witnesses that, that came before the committee and testified in front of the American people.
Here's some things that I noted in there, that all of the witnesses, whether Republican or Democratic, corroborated one another. As you point out, there was not a single dissenting piece of evidence. There was not a single witness that said anything on Donald Trump's behalf. There wasn't a single what we call exculpatory witness, a witness that suggests the president was not guilty. And what's interesting is the only thing they could say was, the Republicans would say they don't know as well as Giuliani and Mick Mulvaney and Pompeo and Bill Barr, Secretary of State, Attorney General, president's lawyer, none of whom are willing to testify, which is fascinating because don't you think if they had evidence that would be that the president wasn't guilty, evidence that tended to exonerate the president, they would jump to testify, wouldn't they? So the fact is, all the evidence is against the president, and the people that refuse to testify, is there any doubt in your mind that if they had stuff that would help Trump, they would be there before that microphone?
Not at all. Actually, I think they would absolutely want to, as you said, jump at that chance. They would want to be there because it would lay to rest all the things that the Democrats had been charging President Trump with, and even some Republicans in private moments have some not too pleasant things to say about what's been going on here. And it becomes really interesting to see how all of this unfolded, because you had various statements, some of them brought out, clearly theories of, that were based on conspiracy theories of what was going on in Ukraine, what was, supposedly going on vis-a-vis the DNC hack, a lot of false information that kept being repeated and repeated. And instead of going for the facts, these congressmen, and all of them were congressmen in this case, really tended to do their best to muddy the waters. And that's, I think, one of the biggest issues here is we're dealing with kind of a post-fact world in that, sometimes the facts don't matter, but what matters is how you express yourself and how, how many talking points you can get across in a given minute or so.
Yeah,
and
that's one of the things that scares
not really
me.
What this is supposed to be about.
Yeah, that really scares me. I'll tell you, looking at the various witnesses, and I was thinking about who was closest sort of to your position, the position you held for 26 years, and the one I came up with was perhaps Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman as the person, as an intelligence officer. But I may be wrong here. Of all the various witnesses, which one do you think most approximated the job you held for 26 years?
Well, probably you're probably right, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. Not that I held the same job for 26 years. I moved into a lot of different positions, and I was never, a member of the National Security Council staff. I worked in other agencies, and I did feed information and policy positions from the Pentagon and other places to the National Security Council at times. His position was pretty close to either what I did do or, you know, what could have been a role that I could have had during my military career at one point in time. So his testimony.
So help us understand, if you would, the position he's in terms of, you know, what you did. I mean, you never obviously had to testify before Congress, I don't think. But in terms of what you did, correct me if I'm wrong. I want to understand it. You would gather information from various sources. You can't discuss sources and methods, but you would gather information about countries, about things that people are doing, and kind of put it in a package for policymakers to understand what's going on around the world. Is that a fair description, rough description?
Absolutely.
Okay. So in that job, what role, if any, and maybe the answer is none, but what role, if any, was politics supposed to play?
Politics could inform things, and you know that the president, no matter who the president was, had certain positions that they wanted to realize, certain goals that they had, certain initiatives, and that's all well and good. That's well within the realm of what a president is supposed to be doing, but never in my experience did anyone come down from the White House and say, this would be, you know, the way we would do things, or we will, in this case, keep aid from a country because we'd withhold that aid because we want them to investigate somebody or anything like that. None of that ever happened, whether it was a Republican administration or a Democratic administration. And this put Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and his colleagues in a very difficult position. Because their job is to be as neutral as possible, gather information, provide policymakers with options, because of their understanding, their deep understanding of a country like Ukraine, provide that expertise about, what's going on in the military in Ukraine, what's going on with the political situation there. All of those things come together in something that a policymaker can then use in order to not only refine their policy, but also to achieve their policies. And
just to sum up, you would basically gather information and disseminate it to the policymakers, and they would act according to their information. But you weren't expected to do actions or to tell countries what to do. Or maybe you were. I mean, help me understand in terms of Vindman's role.
So as far as telling countries what to do, you would obviously expound upon U.S. policies as they exist or existed, and you would help them achieve certain goals, but you would never change things on your own, and you would never take the policymaker's role as your own role. You had a defined role that was to be as much a gatherer of information as well as a disseminator of policy initiatives to your foreign counterparts.
So in 26 years serving as an intelligence officer, and again, if you can't tell me, you can't tell me, but did you ever have occasion to talk to the lawyers? We heard several people saw something going on in the White House and ran to the lawyers because they thought something was wrong. Did that ever happen to you? Can you talk about it?
I had lawyers who worked, with me when I was a commander. And of course, they tended to. I had both sides, the prosecution and the defense, or the equivalent of that. We would prosecute cases based.
Sure. I understand that you would prosecute cases, but I mean, you never saw something going on in the government where you had to blow the whistle or talk to the lawyer or say, "Hey, looks like the government may be doing something illegal." That never came up in 26 years.
No, it never came up in 26 years.
I got to take a break. We have lots more to talk about, including the recent resignation or firing, not sure which, of the Secretary of the Navy. Lots more to talk about. We're going to hear more of Colonel Layton's expertise. And you can call in, too. Just pick up the phone and dial 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275, and you can join in the conversation right back after this.
He's a Bible-quoting, Constitution-loving, flag-waving, red-blooded, liberal American. He's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. Got a conservative who casually misquotes the Bible and the Constitution? Send him to school with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. My guest is Colonel Layton, Cedric Layton, who was in the U.S. Air Force as an intelligence officer for 26 years. And if you heard before the break, he said in 26 years, he never once had occasion to go to the lawyers and say, hey, I see something illegal going on in the government. What we've seen recently is lots of security professionals all over the government who saw something wrong and decided to call the alarm. And I guess my question for you, for Colonel Layton, is give me an idea of what they're thinking. Give me an idea of how hard a decision it is for people to blow the whistle here.
Oh, it's an incredibly difficult thing for them to do, Mark, because they're basing everything that they've done on the trust that exists between them and the institution that they're serving and the people that are serving with them, including their superiors. And that means the political appointees as well as the career folks. And by career folks, we're talking either the civil servants or the military who made that particular department a career. And, when you think about this, they're in essence potentially destroying their careers, or they are going in and making some statements that can bring the wrath of someone like President Trump or other people on them, and that can be a pretty tough thing to do.
These are really brave people. I'd be curious, in the ordinary circumstance that you lived under, is there generally some tension between political appointees and career employees like yourself, or people, Donald Trump always complains about some deep state. Is there a tension there between what the president wants to do and what you do day to day, or is that normally not there?
Oh, there can definitely be tension, between a political appointee, especially a political appointee who is not familiar with the department that he or she is running, and that can lead to some pretty serious issues. But generally speaking, it doesn't rise to the level of a complete breakdown where the political side is doing something that is diametrically opposed to what the career side is doing. The career side is not a deep state. What it is a bunch of dedicated people who are trying to really do the right thing for the country at large, and they're trying to be as apolitical as they possibly can be. That is obviously called into question when they become part of the field of fire in a situation like this one.
So what Dr. Fiona Hill testified to, and I thought she was very persuasive, was that she got mad at Ambassador Gordon Sondland because he was out on this, what she called, domestic political errand, basically to find dirt out on the Bidens. And she was trying to pursue national security policy, and she had no idea at the time, she does now, that the president had personally ordered Sondland to basically go around the dedicated staff. Did that ever happen in your 26 years where the president had a special errand apart from going through national security?
Well, sometimes the president would do things like they'd appoint a special envoy. For example, President Clinton appointed Ambassador Richardson to go and negotiate with the North Koreans.
Right, but all in terms of normal goals. I got to take a quick break, and I'll let you finish after the break. Folks, if you want to call in, it's 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Back after this.
Who says nerds can't be fun? It's Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, talking with Colonel Cedric Layton. He is a former U.S. intelligence officer for 26 years in the U.S. Air Force, and commenting on kind of the inside look at how to think about the people who've come forward for impeachment. Colonel Layton, welcome back. I wanted to ask you, you've seen all these people, Dr. Hill, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, all these ambassadors, a guy like Tim Morrison, who works for the NSC, and a woman who worked for the vice president. They all came to testify, but Secretary Pompeo won't testify. Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney won't testify. Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer, refuses to testify. You've got Rick Perry, energy secretary. You have John Bolton, who no longer works for the government. He refuses to testify. How would you describe the difference between those people testifying and those that aren't? And how would you have approached this, even though, luckily for you, you never had to?
Lucky, didn't I, Mark? I would say that the ones who have testified, the career people who and the ambassadors who have testified, have exhibited courage, and they've done so because they believe in upholding the law. They believe in upholding the principles of the Constitution. Those that have not testified, those who have not testified, are making a big mistake because I think any normal legal opinions, at least ones that I understand, would say that they must testify in front of Congress. Doesn't mean that they can't invoke executive privilege at certain points, but when Congress calls, you answer. I served as a congressional liaison for Air Force Intelligence during my career, and we never ever dreamed of disobeying a congressional request, let alone a subpoena of any type. Luckily, we didn't get many of those, but it was very clear that Congress was the voice of the people. They're in charge, and you respond to that in a way that allows the people to understand what's going on, at least what you can tell them based on what you're doing and how you're being a good steward, hopefully, of the taxpayers' money and the taxpayers' goals.
So yesterday, a D.C. federal district court ruled that Don McGahn, the White House lawyer, who was sued back in March or April of this year, they finally got around to saying, well, of course, Don McGahn, you have to testify. There is no immunity, exactly what you just said, Colonel Layton, and he's going to be required to testify. But, of course, it took 6 months to get it through the courts. Should that ruling therefore encourage John Bolton, for example? It's said that he's writing a book, and I guess he wants to make millions of dollars by disclosing all this in a book. If he testifies before Congress, well, he may not make those millions of dollars, but that's not particularly patriotic. Do you think John Bolton will be inspired by this ruling to come testify, or you think he's still going to avoid it?
Well, I hope he's inspired by the idea that this ruling is really a correct, in my view, interpretation of the Constitution. But I'm afraid that they are going to try to hide behind some kind of legal maneuver. And like you mentioned, if he's going to write a book, or is in the process of doing so, he has an economic interest in revealing the last in some juicy portion of his memoir. But the real thing that people have to understand here, it's not about them, it's about us, it's about our country. It's a patriotic duty to testify in front of Congress. You might not like the Congress people that you're dealing with, but they represent the people, and it's really incumbent upon everybody, if they're called upon to testify, to do so, and to do so in as truthful a manner as possible.
So you were an intelligence officer for 26 years. I did my math. That'd be from 1984 to 2010. Did you deal with Russia at all in your work? And, of course, Russia was very different from the Soviet Union back in 84, actually, all the way up to Putin's Russia of 2010 and today. Did you have occasion to study Russia?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, Russia was number one, whether it took the form of the Soviet Union or, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, became in the demise of communism, became the Russia, that we know today under Putin. In fact, I was in Berlin when the wall came down and spent a lot of time, dealing with the first Soviet and then Russian intelligence target. And the Russians are a very unique entity in many, many ways. And the one thing that we have to remember about them is that their political, geopolitical interests are always going to be somewhat opposed to what we want, and we just have to figure out how to manage them. And what we're seeing now is something that I find very, very, very disturbing in terms of how we're dealing with Russia and how we're letting Russia, in essence, walk all over us.
Well, that's the thing I want to ask you about. And again, not just in Putin's Russia, but over the course of, 26 years, quarter of a century, I want to talk about two things that are sort of known back when it was the Soviet Union, all the way up to today. And one is Russian propaganda, conspiracy theories, election interference, that kind of stuff. And also what the Russians call kompromat, putting people in compromising positions and then using that to blackmail them. Can you give me an idea of the general way the Russians approach propaganda?
So from a propaganda standpoint, they will take something that has a grain of truth in it, you know, something that has happened, and they will find a way to use that particular event by either telling half-truths about it or even outright lying, depending on what serves their interest, and make a story that seems plausible on the face of it, but that serves their interest. So, for example, in the days of the Soviet Union, you would often hear things about, you know, how they, you know, certain political groups in the West and Western Europe in particular, but also in the United States, were really bad people, or that they were really out to get the world and create a situation where we would be diametrically opposed to the peaceful will of the Soviet Union. Well, the Soviet Union's peaceful will was practically non-existent in most cases.
Well, in this and case, they're actually occupying Ukraine. They're occupying territory of a sovereign nation that is considering joining the West. And what's interesting is that even though every one of our intelligence agencies has said Russia intervened in the 2016 election, Russia is trying to say, no, our enemy, Ukraine, did it. This country that we want to occupy, it's all their fault. And even though none of the intelligence officers in the United States believe it, Dr. Fiona Hill said this is just Russian propaganda, there are elements of the Republican Party to this day that are spreading those lies, not least of which is the President of the United States. That's got to be not usual, right?
That's absolutely unusual. And, you know, in the past, what would happen is the president would believe his intelligence agencies and would support his intelligence agencies. What we're seeing now is something that is completely different from that. All of these people, whether it's the president, you know, whether it's Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana, whether it's any of these folks, you know, we could name half a dozen of them right away, they all seem to believe a narrative that is demonstrably false. And this is something, you know, whether left or right, Republican or Democrat, that should really concern every single person, because you can't do anything in life with a false narrative, and let alone run a foreign policy. And that's one thing that, you know, during my time in the military service, we didn't have that issue. We dealt with disinformation. We dealt with the kinds of efforts that the Russians before them, the Soviets, did. But what we had was a coherent policy, and we had a way of dealing with that. In this case, we are really dealing with a two-front war for the people that are here for the truth, for the people that are here that are trying to do the right thing by our country.
So this brings me back to the question of kompromat. I can't recall a U.S. president since the beginning of the Cold War being so solicitous of Russian needs. Ronald Reagan famously called them the evil empire. It seems that whenever a choice is to be made, whether it's pulling troops out of the Middle East, whether it's displaying confidential information, whether it's right in front of Vladimir Putin denying Russian intervention in our elections, the President of the United States and the people who follow him in the Republican Party always is doing whatever Putin wants. Putin, you want the Middle East? You can have it. You want us to delay aid to Ukraine? You have it. And that's unusual, because Republicans were the party, if anything, of strong defense. So that brings me back to the other question of kompromat, which is a fancy Russian term for blackmail, really, where they find some secret information on someone and blackmail them. Just in your opinion, do you think that that is why Donald Trump is helping the Russians so much? Do you think Putin has some kompromat on Donald Trump?
From an intelligence perspective, I think it's entirely possible that the Russians do have kompromat on either President Trump or someone in his family. But I would be willing to bet that if they do have it, that it would be on the president himself. And that is a really, really dangerous situation. But, you know, that would be the kind of thing that would explain a lot of the behaviors that we see and a lot of the very solicitous way in which he's dealing with not only Putin, but all of Russia's geostrategic aims, and it's really putting the United States at a disadvantage.
I think so too. I mean, again, I'm not going to claim evidence where we don't have it yet. But you know, as they say, sometimes where there's smoke, there's fire, and you have to use common sense. And I cannot imagine why a United States president would hand over the Middle East to Russia, would harm this ally Ukraine that is trying to join the West, would basically give up on 70 years of Republican and Democratic presidents fighting the former Soviet Union and Russia for freedom, for democracy, if he weren't under kompromat. But we don't know that's true. So let me just ask you in general, how does kompromat work? What do the Russians do? What does it mean? I know it means compromising information, but you saw it for 26 years. How do the Russians practice kompromat?
So what they'll do, Mark, is they'll take a piece of information, they'll look at somebody, and they'll figure out whether or not that person is a legitimate target from an intelligence perspective. If they think that person is going to have some degree of influence or already has influence, whether they're a business person, a politician, a military person, they will find out what they can. And if they can find some kind of weakness, they will exploit that weakness. So let's say, you know, in the old days, a person who was homosexual couldn't really advertise that in public within our culture. And they would find that, let's say that person was that way, they would take that information and they would, photograph that person in a compromising situation. And then they'd threaten to use that particular information by, opening it up to the press, revealing it to somebody who would then disseminate it in a way, or they would destroy that person's career. So they would, that was one way of doing it. So it could be a sexual thing, it could be a financial thing, it could be a combination of all of the above. And they would use things like that, any weakness that they could exploit, they would use that weakness and find a way in which to leverage that weakness against the individual that they were targeting. And they would make that individual work for them, whether they were witting of that or unwitting of that. And they would do that in a way that they would get the information, they would exploit that information, and then they would discard the person that they had targeted once they became useless to them.
So it's basically blackmail. One of the things that I heard that they would do is they would start with a small offense. So they would ask someone, maybe someone cheated on their wife or hired a prostitute, or maybe someone took some money that they knew they didn't have a right to take. And then they would basically say, we have this on you, and we will use it against you unless you do something more for us, like give us classified material, or I guess in Donald Trump's case, you know, we will help you win the election, and in return, you're going to help us with policy. So they would take something small, find someone who was willing to violate their code or their law or their morals or, you know, their even their marital bonds, and then use that to magnify. Is that what you saw in your 26 years?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Those were the kinds of things that they would do. And you're right. It starts with a very small situation. Unless the person came in directly to the Russians, we had a few of those as well. But generally speaking, they would find somebody who wasn't originally intending to be a spy for them or, you know, to work with them in any way. And they would draw them in slowly but surely. And, you know, every little piece of compromising information or weakness that they could gather on that individual, they would, and then they would hold that over them and say, but we have this, and if you don't do this, we will then reveal this. And then that's basically how they ran this, and how they continue to run these things. And it's a very certainly a very sordid business, but it is something that has been very effective for them over the years.
So, Colonel Layton, for 70 years now, more than 70 years, we have fought the Soviet Union and then Russia, largely fighting democracy against dictatorship, fighting in Europe, fighting all over the world for free countries against dictatorships. And to an almost 100% degree, at least let's say more than 90%, Republicans and Democrats have agreed on this goal. Harry Truman was as, you know, anti-Soviet Union as Ronald Reagan. And Obama, you know, disagreed and may have disagreed in some specifics about policies, but they very much opposed spreading Russian dictatorship, spreading Russian influence. How does it feel now to see an entire party, the Republican Party, with some, to be clear, some wonderful exceptions, people like George Will, Mitt Romney. There are Republicans that are speaking out against this. But it seems like the vast majority of Republicans are involved in this Trump personality cult, even when they know, don't they know, that they're helping Vladimir Putin with his propaganda?
I mean, to me, it seems obvious. When you look at how the Russians behave, and how gleeful they are, including Putin himself, how gleeful he is about the way everything is unfolding in our country. And it does seem, like not only an obvious situation where they would be helping the Russians, but the fact that they don't seem to realize that what they're doing is diametrically opposed to what someone like Ronald Reagan or George H.W. Bush would have stood for. And you look at that and you really come to the conclusion that either they are so deluded by what's going on right now that they don't remember history or don't want to remember history, or they truly believe that there is another path that is a very different path for the traditional Republican Party, and maybe that's why they're doing these things. But that path does not promise much success in my view, because it would really cede a lot of geopolitical ground to a rival that does not have our best interests at heart.
Yeah, I think it's all about power. I think they're willing to basically sacrifice their country for their own power. Even George W. Bush, and I disagreed a lot with the policies of George W. Bush, would not have countenanced handing vast swaths of territory over to the Russians and spreading their propaganda. I don't think he ever would have done that, and I don't think he supports that today. I got to take one more break, Colonel. When we come back, I want to talk about specifically the firing of the Navy Secretary and what's going on in the military, and does the President really want to pardon war crimes, and what does that do for morale within the military? So lots of questions, short time, when we come back right after this.
He's a Fulbright scholar and he speaks French, but he couldn't tell you who won the Super Bowl. It's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. I'm here with Colonel Layton, who spent 26 years as a colonel in the U.S. Air Force in the intelligence. Colonel, I want to know about the morale in the intelligence agencies. We just saw the Secretary of the Navy forced out because he refused to not follow the code of military justice. He wanted to follow it and prevent war crimes. What do you think is going on with morale right now?
Oh, it's in the dumps. Mark, the best way to describe it is, this challenge to the system is a very serious one. The Navy SEAL that started all of this, Eddie Gallagher, the Navy chief, really got off on many of the charges that he was charged with, to include murder. And in spite of that, he was convicted of one charge, posing with a photograph of an ISIS fighter, a dead ISIS fighter. And that, of course, is against the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And that kind of situation where you take the rules and discipline that we have and upend that can only make it much more difficult for us to have the effective fighting force that we have had to up until this point. And it's very dangerous for the future of our country and for our military.
Do you expect more resignations? Is this just the beginning of dominoes? What do you think?
I think it's possible. I think there may be a lot more people who will stand on principle. Of course, it depends on the particular situation and how they and their organization are going to be affected by it, whatever the situation is. But I think in this case, this is making it far more likely that we'll see a few more dominoes fall before the end of even the next few months.
And we're running out of time, only about 30 seconds left. But other than impeaching the president, what can anyone do to help shore up the system? What can ordinary citizens do?
ordinary citizens can tell their elected representatives that it's time to go back to a system that has worked well for us over the last 240-plus years. It's time for us all to become constitutionalists and
really... I have to end it there.
That aren't.
Colonel Layton, thank you for coming on the show.